way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to think.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, June the 18th, 2026, and we're rounding out the week under our new schedule of 3 days a week. And Thursday has remained unchanged from the past, even the recent or the distant past, honestly. Expert counsel, Q&A shows for the week. This is where we have this amazing group of people, and if you want to know more about them, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Hover on the About tab and then click on Meet the Expert Council. You can see all of the people you can ask these questions to. These are amazing people with tremendous insight and a lot of knowledge that are able to handle questions outside of my wheelhouse, sometimes inside of my wheelhouse with a different perspective. But there is no way I could bring the variety that I bring to you on Thursdays with as much depth of knowledge without these folks. And they deserve a huge thank you for the service they've given us over the years. Some have come and gone. Some of these people that are here now have been here from the very beginning. Some are new. Who do we got today? Because we have way more experts than we have spaces per week. I try to get everybody to give me at least two segments a week. Some people are rock stars like Dr. Ron Paul's team and Andy McCann, and they give me more than I could probably even use. And some are right hit that nail dead on the head with two, and sometimes people pike. But anyway, we're still blessed to have them all. Here's who we have today. Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams are here, and they are going to talk to us about what it's going to take for the U.S. to finally change our misguided and failed foreign policy. And I agree with their segment here like 85%. I think there is a tremendous amount of Trump hatred out there, and there is a need that some people have, especially people that have a need to despise a certain ally that we have in the Middle East. They always have to take things to another level with criticism, which I find weak. And I'll tell you why I find it weak. Because there's plenty to criticize without doing it. But anyway, I'll give you my thoughts on it when we hear specifically what Dan has to say about that, as we're all kind of have some counterpoints. Jesse Markowitz is going to say, he's going to answer a simple question. What is a VPN? What does it do? How does it help? And do you need one? Or might you want one even if you don't necessarily need one? Great segment that he put together for us on that. Then Chef Ken Daniels with the most controversial discussion of cooking that we've had yet in almost 18 years on the show. Horse. And I love the approach Ken took toward this. And I find this really interesting. When I saw this segment and started listening to it, I'm like, well, I've never eaten horse, but I have eaten zebra. And it turns out to do his research, he had to get a hold of some meat. And in the United States, the only legal option was zebra. And I bet they're very similar. Ryan Steve will answer a question about direct pumping from a river when you have a long way to go, like 1,500 feet, and hundreds of feet of lift needed. We'll listen to that one together. I have some thoughts on it, too. Andy McCann will talk about wearable health and fitness tech, like Fitbits, but other things as well. And I have some concerns about this type of tech. It turns out Andy and I are completely in sync, though, on it does have value, but, and he'll talk about that. Michael Melito will answer one of the best philosophical questions for outdoorsmen. Why do we hunt? And he has invited me for my thoughts on this, and I listened to his segment. I'm like, I could not even do an anchor segment today. That could be my anchor segment. And then I thought about it deeper and thought, I'll give a little bit of response. This is a great topic for a future show, Why We Hunt. I think it's the name of a book that I read all the way back in high school. It was written from a very philosophical standpoint by somebody who's not a hunter. I thought that book was really interesting. I'll try to find that while we're listening to the other experts today. And if I do find it, I will add a link in the show notes to it. But it may be long out of print because I really do believe that I read that book when I was like a junior in high school. Anyway, and then my anchor segment, which is going to happen today and is not going to be Why We Hunt, is going to be what's coming in the next chapter of the Survival Podcast. There's a bunch of stuff that's about to start showing up, and I want you to know about it. It kind of is all tied into the Laws of Life book series. But we're moving past even that. There's some other books that are coming. There's workbooks that are coming. I've talked about this a little bit, but I've never really given like a dedicated, you know, 5-10 minute segment to this, and to where the plans are going, and to what's going on with Jack's Laws, what's going on with coursework and AI coursework expanding, and what really is kind of a next chapter in my life from a professional career standpoint. Don't worry, TSP. I know when some people say that, you're like, oh, no, no. TSP is going nowhere. The 3-day work week has been in the plans for years. I want you to know that. Like, before we even went to 4 last year, Dorothy and I have been talking about this for about 5 years. And this was something that I slowly moved into, and 3 has been the target to get to for a long time. The question is, other than screwing off, what do I do at that time? I'm not good at screwing off. I have to have something to focus on. Dorothy wants to travel more. It all meshes together. You have to trust me, but there will be survival podcasts for a long time to come. A 3-day work week is a cakewalk for me if you think about where this all started. And that gives me the, well, we'll just save it. We'll just save it because, you know, we're going to come back to it. So I want to start off today. I'm going to give you the item of the day up front instead of at the end. I was thinking there's a couple things that I need to get some videos of to put up for you. One is actually a recycled product, but I have a new use for it, and I don't want to tell you what it is or bring it back around until I get that done. And I got a couple other things I need to do some videos on for you. So I needed a kind of a recycled item today, or just rerun what I did yesterday, you know. And I thought, well, you know, cooking's always a good topic. We got Chef Ken on today. Let's look at the T-Spaz page for cooking. So I did that. And about the fourth item down of the last reviewed was the Merton and Stork carbon steel skillets. So I'm like, well, hey, I just ran that in May, but let me see if it's on sale. It is. 20% off. $47. I'm going to put it to you bluntly. This is what I put in the price alert for the reposting of it today. Forget hundreds of dollars on a Gordon Ramsay endorsed hex clad or anything like that. This is one of the best pans that will ever grace your kitchen. It's very affordable and knocked down under $50 with 20% off today. A 90-day low Amazon price on this awesome item. Guys, I have been recommending carbon steel for years. I've always recommended both cast iron and carbon steel with different viewpoints, but the cast is more for your long-term oven cooking, Dutch oven, slow sear, stuff like that. When you want to cook hot and fast, carbon steel is superior in every way. But I was unwilling to like tell people to spend $200 on a freaking piece of steel flattened out and milled. It's just too much money. So I always defaulted to the Lodge brand, which is pretty damn good. But one problem Lodge tends to have is they're a little bit raised in the center, and it's just annoying. I mean, I went through the extra steps of, like, leveling my stove so that when you put an egg in the center of the pan, it doesn't run to the other end of the pan. And then the pan has a little concave, or actually convex, I guess, center to it. It's annoying. And the texture is less than it could be, but it's and the longer you cook with it, the more nonstick it becomes. But surely we could do better. About 2 years ago, I discovered Merton and Stork. And the pan was everything that I would have changed about the Lodge if Lodge would have come to me and asked. Longer handle, unless you stick it in the oven or something or leave it on the burner a long time, the handle stays cool enough to touch. Now, be careful with that. Like, you can break anything as far as, you know, what you can get away with. But in general, when you're cooking hot and fast, that handle does not heat up too much to be able to move the pan around or whatever using the handle without a mitt. So I like that. It's a little bit deeper, a little bit straighter walled, so you get less stuff flying out of it, especially when you're doing a pan toss instead of a pan stir. The milling is smooth, like baby's ass smooth. I'm telling you, it really is. There's no cast appearance. There's no beading. It is milled smooth. The factory finish, it does get better the more you use it, but you can take it out of the box and, you know, maybe wipe it down and give it a good clean off, and you can just start using it. It is dead flat in the bottom, so when you put the stuff in the bottom that you don't want all to run to one side or run off the center, it stays where you put it. It's oven safe. It's heavy duty riveted. This is a pan, honest to God, the Lodges run between $50 and $60 for a 12-inch pan. That's your most universal size. that when it came out, if it was 85, 90 bucks, even up to around 100, I would have said, spend twice the money if you have to. Get this pan. It's that much better. The dadgone thing is within a few bucks of the lodge equivalent size on a day-to-day basis. German made, German steel, German engineering. Jack, I thought you were pro-America. I am pro-America. We don't make this without it costing $300. And I'm not willing to pay that much for it. I don't think you should either. If you do not have this pan in your kitchen, 47 bucks, pick it up today, and you'll see why I am so enamored with this pan. I pretty much have one I use every day. I'm buying another one just to have a second pan. I've been using my Lodge 12-inch skillet. It's kind of like, well, when I'm not using it, I need two. I'll just use the Lodge. I don't need another. I'll get another one at this price. You try it, you'll see why. All right, with that, let's dig into it. What is it going to take for America to change our foreign policy? My difference on the take here is I think maybe we are. Ron alludes to that, and I don't think Dan can accept it, I guess. I'm not sure. You tell me what you think. After you listen to this, I'll tell you what I think, and we'll go from there.
We're going to be talking about this agreement. It's not a treaty. On Friday, and I think that sounds like it might be, when, tomorrow or the next day. Maybe they're moving in the right direction and something will happen. But there's a lot of people now, you know, they got wind of exactly what they're getting ready to sign. And they certainly didn't want the people in the Congress to know what was in the details of this. But the more the people learn, the more complaints that we're hearing about. You know, the hawks are really unhappy with this because the last thing a hawk wants is the diminishing of the conflict. I mean, I don't know what drives them. There's a lot of things. There's money, there's weapons, there's politics. You know, who knows what motivates these people, but they like to see action.
Yesterday, Bloomberg released the 14 points of the memorandum, and it was a real eye-opener, especially for those who have been listening to the president and his administration this whole time. It's probably shocking. I mean, we won 50 times, and they've been defeated and begging for a deal. Turns out it was all talk. Iran cleaned up. They ran the table. And closing that strait was their checkmate, you know, and it was all talk ever since then. And not just closing it, but threatening everyone that tried to go through to the point where nobody would insure it, and backing it up. If anyone tried, the missiles were flying. So all they're defeated, their navies at the bottom of the ocean, it was all a big story, you know, for the American people. And American people, I guess, still like listening to stories. That's just the way it is. But the reality now is this hundreds of billions are going to be, $300 billion for reconstruction, all these billions that instead of making America great again, are going to Iran. Isn't that nice for our country? How many failures is it going to take for the American government to finally change foreign policy?
Yeah, what drives me crazy is that there is so much to dislike about Donald Trump, and there's a lot to like as well. There's like this kind of balance. Like, I've never had a politician that I was like, oh, I'm all in with everything they do. I mean, even Thomas Massey, I don't 100% agree with. Even Dr. Paul, I don't 100% agree with. But there's just so much to criticize. But the detractor needs to embellish everything and extrapolate information that you do not have. And here's what I mean. The government and the taxpayers are going to give Iran $300 million. I don't know that yet, and you don't either. And I don't think that's the case. At least it's not how it's being communicated, which could be a lie. But then say that! Because the way that this has been presented thus far is that investment will be encouraged. In other words, private entities will be investing in Iran. That's how this has been presented. Now, if you want to say, I don't believe that, great. I have skepticism myself. But you can't just say, like, oh, instead of making America great with $300 billion, which no one is saying that was ever behind the idea of doing that in the first place, including you, Dan. I'm sorry, you're not. You're not. Okay? So don't pretend that you were for the thing that now it's convenient to pretend that you were for. state the reality. There's this promise, and it's also phased. In other words, like, Iran does this thing, and then we do this thing, and then Iran does this thing. Will it work? I don't know. Am I skeptical? Yes. But I'm not going to criticize what I don't know as though I do know. And this is a very dangerous thing if you want any kind of discourse politically in a country, because this is the honest to God truth. There's a list of sayings, probably 30 or 40 things that a person can say about the Trump administration, that once they say one of those things, I don't give a flying F what you say after that. I am done listening to you. When you complain, Trump said he's going to do this, he's crazy, and then he doesn't do it, you go, taco, I'm done. I'm done. And there's 100 more things like that, probably. There's at least a couple dozen. And if you want to be taken seriously as a critic, then you need to apply serious criticism, not extrapolate things you don't know as though you do. And this would be the case if it was Barack Obama. This would be the case if it was George W. Bush the first or the second, or if it was Bill Clinton, or if J.D. Vance becomes the next president, or God help us all, Gavin Newsom, right? Or whoever else, right? Like, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't even matter the position. They could be a senator. They could be a governor. They could be a representative. When you start criticizing something, when you don't even really fully know what's going on yet, it detracts from your argument even when you're right, even when you're 100% right. This is why, and I hope I've earned some credibility with this over the years, things will happen, and often they happen, like, let's say, on a Sunday afternoon, and then I go live Monday, and everybody expects me to just jump all over it. And if we have enough information, I do. But how many times have you heard me say, I'm not ready to go there. Here's my surface level exam. Let me dig deeper. We don't know enough yet. And then, you know, 2 days later, I come out with a very detailed explanation of my take. Do we need more of that, not less of that? One of my real problems with alternative journalism is it's tending toward not being journalism either. Some of the best work that was done in the past, and I'm not talking about Dr. Paul here, I'm grateful to have them as a partner. But here's an example. There's a couple that do a show called Redacted, extremely popular, way bigger than me, million plus YouTube subscribers, and the work they were doing 5 years ago was fantastic. Now, any sensational bullshit they'll grab onto. Anything that gets, no matter how ridiculous, no matter how out of bounds the conspiracy theory is, and they will present it as though it's verified. We have to stop this. You cannot let blind hatred lead you any more than blind patriotism. Both are extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. The good I see out of this, it seems like the orange man has started to tell old Benny over there in Israel, yeah, we don't work for you. We don't do everything you say. You don't like it? I don't really care. You're not the one funding it. You're not the one fighting it. You're not the one doing it. I guess you're our strongest and greatest ally, but sometimes it's important to know who actually is in control. And this could actually spell bad news for Orange Man, because Israel generally doesn't like being told that. I'll save my thoughts on more about that as we see what comes from it. Anyway, let's move on and talk about something totally, and I do mean totally different. VPNs, also known as virtual private networks. You hear about these on TV crime shows, and somebody in like some analyst position who was a former hacker who now works for the FBI, the CIA, or the NSA, or somebody, typing 1,000 miles an hour, and used a VPN and 37 proxies, and I can't find it. It's all nonsense. Okay, it's all stupidity. But VPNs are very useful, and they are a measure of privacy protection, among other things. They have other utilities. So, do you need one? Where does it help? What can you do with it? And how does it work? With all of that in mind, I give you Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today's question is straightforward. What is a VPN, and when does it actually help? VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. It's a way of encrypting a network connection between computers. If you work for a big company, they may have you install a VPN client on your device to connect securely into their network. For personal use, you might use tools such as WireGuard or Tailscale to connect your device to your home network or a commercial VPN provider. There are a number of cases where VPNs can help. First, if you're using an untrusted local internet connection, such as a coffee shop, airport, or hotel Wi-Fi, this can protect you from that local network. Imagine you're at a coffee shop mailing letters. Without a VPN, you drop your letters in an open basket where people nearby can see who you're communicating with. With a VPN, you put those letters into a locked mailbox. The coffee shop can see that you use the locked box, but not who the letters are going to. The mailman, the VPN provider, opens the box, sees where the letters are going, and forwards them. While the coffee shop knows less, the VPN provider does see that information. The exposure has moved. Second, many employers require remote workers to use a VPN to connect to company systems securely. For you personally, when you're on the road, you could use a VPN configured on your home router to connect to your network there so you can access your devices as if you're home. This could be a StarOS server, a file server, cameras, printers, home automation, or anything else. This could also be used so that any websites, like Amazon or Netflix, that try to route you to their local country site instead of your home location, see you as being at home. Third, a VPN helps when you do not want to provide your home IP address to the websites and services you visit. MaxMind, one of the big commercial IP geolocation providers, estimates that they can identify users at the country level with 99.8% accuracy. For IPs located within the U.S., they estimate around an 80% accuracy at the state and region level and a 66% accuracy for cities. It doesn't give up your street address, but it can locate you within a metropolitan area. Try it now. Go to maxmind.com, scroll down the page, and see what location it guesses. When you use a VPN from your device, the sites you visit will see your IP address and location as those of your VPN, not your local IP. This can help with local filtering, censorship, or network restrictions. If a hotel, school, office, country, or internet provider blocks certain services, a VPN may route around that. I say may because some networks block VPNs too, and in some cases, using one may violate terms of service or local law. VPNs are powerful and can change what your IP address looks like to the sites you visit, but don't get overconfident. Sites you visit can identify you in other ways. If you log into your account or enter your name or email address or other information, the site you connect to can know it is you. If your browser has the same cookies, same fingerprint, behavior, accounts, changing the IP address only does so much. Go to browserleaks.com to see other information sites can see about your system. Depending on a client's situation, my Bitcoin risk assessment sometimes includes using a VPN to better protect personal privacy. If your wallet talks to someone else's node, that server may learn which addresses or transactions you care about and connect that activity to your home IP address. Running your own node helps, but your node still talks to the broader Bitcoin network. A VPN does not fix every privacy problem, but it can reduce the chance that your home IP address gets tied directly to your Bitcoin activity. Finally, be careful with free VPNs. Running a VPN server costs money. If you're not paying, you need to ask, why are they doing this? How are they making money? Are they logging your activity, selling data, injecting ads, doing something else? Not every paid VPN is good, and not every free VPN is evil. If you're going to trust a VPN, you should understand who you're trusting. A VPN is not a get-out-of-tracking-free card. It's a useful tool when you know who you're trying to hide from, who you're choosing to trust instead, and what problem you're actually trying to solve. If you want personal help with your own VPN setup, Bitcoin privacy, self-hosting, or a Bitcoin risk assessment, reach out to me at jesse@yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. I do one-on-one consulting, and I'm happy to help you think through your specific situation. This has been Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Please keep sending in the questions. Always happy to answer the questions from Survival Podcast listeners.
Good stuff from Jesse, and I'll just say that a VPN is one of those things that's, well, it's kind of like a cordless jigsaw, right? That's an item that every once in a while goes on super cheap sale, especially BearTool only in the DeWalt set. And if you use, you know, Rigid or Bosch or whatever, yeah, it's the same type of thing. And whenever it goes on sale, though, and I see it go on like a super low price, I always bring it around as an item of the day as a BearTool. And I'm like, it's one of those tools that you won't, like, you could, you know what you do with it, but you won't really, like, value it until you have it. Like, there's so many things that you can do with a jigsaw that you can get by with other tools with, but when you have the jigsaw, you're like, oh, I see. And that's how I see a VPN. Like, You know, when you're dealing with something where you're trying to view a piece of content that's been blocked because of the country you're in, whether it's your own or some other place you're visiting, and you can just, like, take a couple clicks and then all of a sudden it's there. That alone is incredibly powerful, and not just seeding everywhere, every place you go with, hey, it's me. That's nice. And that's one of those things, like, you don't realize the freedom of that until you operate under it, right? And there's a lot of great VPN options out there. And Jesse is right. The VPN provider can still see what you're doing. And it doesn't make you Jason Bourne. But there are providers who tend to be a little bit more trustworthy than others. And I'll leave it at that for now. Let's talk about something extremely controversial. For some people, this may be more controversial than our opening segment about the Middle East eating a horse. I'm going to let Ken do this excellent segment, let you listen to it. I'm going to come back with just a few thoughts to potentially change the lens through which you view this subject.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from a listener living in the Middle East. He's originally from the United States, but for security reasons, we'll leave it at that. His question is simple. How do I cook horse? What makes it different? Why is it so common here while most Americans never even consider it food? And honestly, this may be one of the longest and most controversial research projects I've done for the show. Not because the answer was difficult, because access was difficult. Horse occupies a very strange place in the American culture. The second you bring it up, people stop hearing a culinary discussion and start hearing something emotional. People start thinking about westerns and ranches and childhood memories and companionship and everything else except the actual meat itself. Even bringing this up in my industry, both meat processing and the chef world caused hardened good old boys to freak out. And I wasn't interested in debating whether horses should be eaten. I was interested in understanding why cultures built food traditions around it. And the problem was obvious in the United States. I couldn't easily find horse firsthand. So I had to get creative. That eventually led me to zebra. And yes, I understand how ridiculous that sounds. It's completely legal to butcher and cook zebra in the United States. Horse, not so much. But zebra was one of the closest legal comparisons available to me, and more importantly, it gave me something tangible to work with. And horses and zebras spend their lives moving. They're endurance animals. They travel, they work, they cover distance. They aren't built like cattle. Horses convert calories into movement. That difference becomes obvious the second you start examining the meat. The first thing that jumped out to me was the lack of marbling. If you spent years cooking beef, marbling becomes your safety net. Fat protects texture. Fat protects moisture. Fat gives you room to make mistakes. Horse-type animals do not provide that luxury. The second thing I noticed was the grain. The muscles were longer, cleaner, more defined. Looking at the cuts laid out in front of me, my brain immediately went to venison. Suddenly, the traditional preparations from around the world began making perfect sense. And something else happened during this process. Around the same time I was researching horses, I came across a discussion online about a massive wild boar that had been shot and left discarded. The comments were very sad, but also predictable. Ah, it's too big, it's too old, it's too tough, it's not worth processing, it's not worth eating. And I remember reading those comments and thinking how similar the mindset was to the horse conversation. People weren't evaluating the animal, they were evaluating the effort. The moment an animal becomes difficult, whether emotionally or physically, many people decide it becomes worthless. And historically, that's simply not how humans survived. Utilizing what is around you, opportunities to practice any of these core survival techniques is vastly important, even if the animal isn't perfect. Nobody built traditional cuisines around perfect animals. They built them around animals they had. Old animals, lean animals, tough animals. Animals that required knowledge instead of convenience. And honestly, if you've ever been hungry or watched someone you care about go hungry, the idea of throwing away opportunities to learn those skills start feeling less like sophistication and more like a damn luxury. Because every difficult animal teaches you something. And horse turned out to be one of the best teachers I've encountered in a long time, even if it was through zebra. The more I studied it, the more I realized the controversy wasn't culinary at all. The controversy was cultural. The cooking itself became remarkably logical. And if you've never taken the time to practice on an animal that may not be the perfect scenario, you'll find yourself ill-equipped and ignorant when the times get tough. So once I stopped thinking about horse as a controversy and started thinking about it as an endurance animal, the butchery became easier to understand because anatomy doesn't care about hurting your delicate feelings about processing Mr. Ed, okay? The first cut I worked with was the loin because that's where most people start. It's also where most people make the most mistakes. The loin looked familiar enough that your brain immediately wants to compare it to beef, and that is very dangerous. Beef has conditioned us to expect marbling. We expect fat to protect us. We expect tenderness to be built into the cut itself. Horse-type animals do not work that way. The loin reminded me much more of venison backstrap than any steak from a steer. The muscle was dense but fine-grained. There was very little internal fat. The color was darker than beef, not dramatically darker, but enough that you notice it immediately. And the biggest lesson came from the first cook. The meat wanted restraint, dry surface, hot pan, add fat, short cooking time, and then leave it alone. Salt, black pepper, a little coriander, nothing complicated. Medium rare is not a suggestion, it's the target. Once you push beyond that, the texture changes quickly. Most people don't think about neck meat or shanks. A neck braise with some stock, onions, garlic, over time transforms completely. That collagen slowly breaks down into gelatin, and the texture changes from tough to this luxurious cut. The same lessons appear when you look into the shanks. And honestly, if I had to pick the cut that fascinates me the most during this entire project, it might be the shanks. They're loaded with connective tissue. They're tough. They're stubborn. They're absolutely magnificent when you cook them correctly. The first thing that came to mind was also buco. Long cooking, moist heat, patience. You aren't forcing tenderness into the meat. You're allowing the collagen to become gelatin. The animal does the work. You simply give it enough time. And honestly, I think most people overlook this cut because modern cooking has trained us to value tenderness over flavor. And the irony is that some of the most flavorful cuts on any animal are the ones that require the most patience. And then there's sausage. The more I studied horse cookery traditions, the more sausage kept appearing. At first, I thought it was cultural preference. Then I realized it was practical anatomy. The animal is lean, very lean. Sausage solves that problem beautifully. You can introduce fat intentionally. You can balance texture. You can preserve meat. You can utilize trim. What looks like cultural tradition on the surface is often an engineering solution underneath. Horse cultures didn't accidentally develop these techniques. Every traditional preparation addressed a challenge presented by the animal itself. Because the more I learned, the more horse stopped looking like an unusual food and started looking like it actually is. A highly athletic animal that rewards precision, patience, and understanding. And once you understand the anatomy, the cooking becomes remarkably straightforward. Hey, thank you for your question, especially on this one. You can reach me at BloodSugarChef.com. And until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Giddy up.
So let me just tell you, I think that there is a very obvious reason as to why Americans have this affinity for horses, and it's because until about 1910, and I know that's a long, long time ago, and there's like nobody that was around that can remember 1910 that's still alive. You'd be, 136 if you were born in 1910 right now, right? So it would be 116, yeah. Yeah, okay, 116, right? So I get that we don't have a lot of 125-year-olds running around that can tell you what it was like back then. But up until about then, there weren't really any cars. Like, if you look at a picture of New York City from 1900, the street is full of horses and buggies and carriages and horse shit. And if you look at a picture of New York City in, let's say, 1915, there's almost no horses. And so the horse got replaced by the horseless carriage. That's why they called it that. But the horse didn't go away that quickly from standard American life, even into the 30s and 40s. And now we're into a time frame when a lot of people can remember things. The horse was still a major part of American life. Stanley of the Stanley Steamer Car, Mr. Stanley, retired to Estes Park, Colorado, where I just spent a pretty long vacation. And the Stanley Hotel's there, and his house that he has there, and you can't be in Estes and not hear about Mr. Stanley. And when we took this ride in a Jeep up into Rocky Mountain National Park, a guided ride, the gentleman that drove the Jeep and was like our tour guide as we went past the Stanley and Mr. Stanley's house, he told us some things about Mr. Stanley. And he said, you know, a lot of people think that just because you're rich, that means you're not generous or whatever, and you're a bad guy or whatever. But Mr. Stanley was a very good guy, and he talked about all the philanthropy and things that he did while he was alive and living in Estes Park. And one of the things he did is if you graduated from high school, now understand there were only so many people living there at the time, but if you graduated from high school and you wanted to go to college, Mr. Stanley would pay your college tuition if you were a citizen of Estes Park and graduated from high school there. Pretty damn generous, you know. And it wasn't through like some big old foundation or whatever, like basically you paid the tuition bill. But not everybody goes to college. And that was even more true back in, you know, the 1890s, early 1900s. And so what the guy said is, if you didn't want to go to school, but you wanted help getting started out, he would buy you a horse. And my wife turns to me and goes, why a horse? And I said, because today that would be like buying somebody a new car. It was how you got places. It was, I mean, there was a time in this country stealing a man's horse got you hung. It was a capital crime because if he stole a man's horse while he was out on the range or crossing the desert or something, he could die. That's how the American culture is based on a culture of cooperation with the horse. And even though we're about 100 years away from it now, as a major thing, the vestiges are there. The other side of it is horses are incredibly intelligent, and they bond with humans. And they have an expressiveness in their eyes that makes us have affinity for them. And then we just don't eat them. And since we just don't eat them, it's become taboo. And I would tell you this, if humans kept pet pigs in mass, not the way a few people do with like the teacup pigs and the potbelly. If it was as common to see a person walking a pig in a park as it is to walk a dog, we probably wouldn't eat pigs either. Not with any regularity, because pigs are also very intelligent and form bonds. They also stay dangerous compared to, and horses can be very dangerous as well, but compared to a cow, they're much more calculating. That's why you even have a law about be the pig, not the cow. So there's a lot of subjectiveness to this, but I want to put a different lens on it. Let's imagine that you and I and a bunch of other people crossed a giant ocean, kind of like happened back in like the 1500s, and we came to a new land, kind of like happened back in the 1500s and 1600s. But for some reason, we were in a modern world with modern guns and everything we have now, but we went to this modern land. Let's say that we traveled to another planet. Right, and there were no horses on Earth. We had never seen a horse. Nobody knows. There was no zebras. Nothing ever looked like a horse. We had all our other megafauna, but we had never seen a horse. And we get in this giant starship, and we go, I don't know, 30 light years, and we find an Earth-like planet with no sentient life. And we decide we are going to build a new colony here. We are going to create Earth 2. You know, we're like a sci-fi movie. And we are going to use what we brought. Maybe we have some genetic engineering we can do and clone some things, but we're also going to use what's there. But we have modern tech. In other words, we have cars and trucks, like, or the, you know, whatever you'd have at the point that you could actually travel the stars like that, right? So we don't really need beasts of burden. We have enough automation, engineering, and energy capability, which you'd have to have to make this journey. And we look out and we say, look, let's find the animals and the plants on this planet that are good for human use. And we came across a herd of horses. And again, we don't know what a horse is. Would we not go, I think I could eat that? And I think if you would say, you would say that if it was the, if we substituted in buffalo never existed here, American bison, and you found those, you'd be like, I could eat that, right? If the cow never existed here and you saw the cow wandering around as a wild animal, I could eat that. The pig, the same, right? A chicken, the same. Like if you think of all the things we routinely eat, and if you would say, yeah, if I saw that there and I never saw one before, I'd be like, I could eat that. And then you say you wouldn't about a horse, I don't think you're being intellectually honest. It doesn't mean you should go out and start eating horses. I understand everything else I said in the beginning. I'm just saying that is a lens that we might want to look through to understand things, because things may not always be as perfect as they are right now. You don't think things are perfect right now, I know, but I'm going to tell you, there are some times in history that if you had a, if you were living in that time and somebody scooped you up and dropped you where you are right now with all the bitching you do, you'd go, this is freaking perfect. I don't want to go back. And that is a fragile state of humanity. The stability we have enjoyed specifically since World War II is not the norm in humanity. So getting outside the box with your thinking for a subject like this is interesting. Now, I don't plan to go eat horse anytime soon, but I would not degrade a culture who considered it another meat animal. But see, the horse has different utility. I think I know exactly where this person is from, and the horse is a very utilitarian animal there too. And I'll just put it this way. When a peasant farmer in England in the Middle Ages, and even in the modern time, the kind of like up until like the Victorian era and go back, were using oxen to plow, that oxen would get to a point where it really couldn't do the job anymore. And they didn't kill it or let it retire. They either let it retire and just like wait till it fell over and keep feeding it. And they didn't kill it and then have a ceremony for it and bury it in the ground. They slaughtered it and they ate it, because it would have been considered wasteful to do otherwise. And there is a certain thing that happens when you keep livestock. There is a certain bond, even with many animals, that it makes it more difficult. And that's okay. And maybe it would be good for us spiritually, and I'll save this for my follow-up on Mike's segment at the end, but maybe it would be good for us spiritually to be more in touch with the fact that when we do consume meat, it is the sacrifice of a life, and that sacrifice is given to us. Maybe we don't need to insulate ourselves from that quite as much as we do. Maybe we don't have to not be highly carnivorous to accept that. Or we could still be highly carnivorous and accept that, is what I'm trying to say. Anyway, that was longer than I planned. Let's move on and let's talk about direct pumping water from a river up a really, really steep hill.
Hey, TSB community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a question from James, and James asks, what is the most economical way to lift water 250 feet over a distance of 1,500 feet? So his details are, my home is at 930 feet elevation and is at the peak of a hill, which is bordered by about a 3/4 mile of river, which is at 680 feet of elevation. I have deeded access to use the river for irrigation. Unfortunately, the river is about 1,500 feet away and 250 feet lower in elevation than my home. I am thinking direct solar with well pump might be the simplest option to fill a pond or dam near the house, or maybe creating a series of water battery reservoirs stepping up the hill using smaller ponds or storage tanks at intervals that are powered by smaller pumps, so that I don't have such a heavy load to try to draw 250 feet at once. All right, so let's start first. First things first, I am going to be able to answer this question more from the perspective of this is how I would do it rather than should you do it, because, James, I'd have to see your property. I'd have to talk with you about what your goals are and see what your other possibilities are, like, say, water catchment from roofs or other options before I tell you if this is a good idea. But I'm just going to pretend like it's a good idea and tell you how to do it if it is. So first of all, I would entirely scrap the idea of using multiple pumps and multiple tanks or ponds. The reason is that if you have one failure anywhere in that chain, whether it's a pump, a solar panel, a wire that gets chewed through, a dam that bursts, a pond that stops holding water, the entire system stops working. So I would scrap that one entirely. The thing I would use in this case is a direct solar well pump, a submersible well pump, because they're actually designed to lift water higher than that height. I'm going to include two for Jack to put in the show notes. One is going to be the Backwoods solar pump that I've used before and love. I think it works great, and I would highly recommend that. But if you're a gambling person and want to use a cheaper option, I'm going to include that. I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm going to include it partially just so that if there's other people listening to this and they want a similar solution in a less strenuous environment, they could try the much less expensive option first if they wanted to. All right, so here's how I would do this. First of all, you're going to take the what I would recommend is the Backwoods Solar Direct Solar Well DC Well Pump. You're going to put in anywhere from about 4 to 6 400-watt solar panels, and those are going to power this well pump. And the well pump is going to need to have access to the river. Now, how you do that and what you're allowed to do with that is going to be dependent on what your lease says. And for those of you listening, the lease is actually a huge deal, because if you start monkeying with pumping water out of a river, you have the potential to run afoul of the Army Corps of Engineers, and they tend to not be real kind about finding anybody who's violating what they consider is their waterway. And when you're putting the pump in, you want to make sure that it's, one, not going to wash away in floods, two, still going to be under the water in low, like drought conditions, and three, isn't going to be damaged by boats or ideally not very noticed by people passing by. So coming out of the well pump, you're going to put a check valve, so that makes sure that water can't push back down and into the river, so all the work that the pump does pumping water up won't come back. And then you need to run a line to your home, which you're saying is about 1,500 feet. Now, what I would generally recommend would be 1.5 inch poly line. So this would be 1.5 inch poly line rated at 200 PSI. Unfortunately, that has become extremely expensive. I have run a very similar system to this on 1.25 inch poly, but I wouldn't go less than the 160 PSI poly, and you should probably just go with, or assume you should go with the 200 PSI poly. Because of the head that you have, you're going to have 110 PSI static or consistent pressure, and the 160 PSI rated is just a little closer than I'd like to be. It doesn't give quite as much margin. So I would go with the 200 PSI poly if you can. Otherwise, you could also go with PEX. But keep in mind that PEX has a smaller inside diameter than it's rated for. So, for example, a 1-inch PEX is going to actually be a 0.88 inch inside diameter, or ID. And that's really important when you're moving water over a long distance. It's absolutely vital that you reduce pipe drag. And the way you do that is have a larger inside diameter. You could also look at PVC, but that's gone way up in price as well. But 1.5 inch or 1.25 inch PVC would be a decent option, but has the potential to crack if it's bent too far. Then I would pump it up to a poly tank at the top of the hill. And the reason I'm suggesting a poly tank rather than a pond is, one, it's going to be more accessible and usable. Two, you're going to have a lot less debris in it if you want to pump it somewhere else. And the final reason is that a pond can fail, or it can start to allow a lot of that water to seep down into the ground, so it's not going to be as consistent or usable. And I generally recommend a 2,500-gallon poly tank that you can get from Lowe's. And the reason for that is that Lowe's carries it consistently, so not only is it less expensive, but if you ever want to get a second one that's identical so that you can put them side by side and connect them, they're going to be a lot more available. So now you've got the water being pumped up from the bottom. It's going up and into and filling that tank. And what I'm going to suggest is not to put any type of valve on there, but to let it overflow. And you're going to take that overflow pipe and run that to your pond. And that's going to keep your pond full. That way you always have a known quantity of clean water at 2,500 gallons or however big of a tank you use. And the other huge benefit to this system is that there's back pressure on that line going downhill. So at the bottom of the hill, you're going to have 110 PSI. As you go up the hill, that PSI or back pressure on the pipe is going to go down, and it's going to be calculated by the amount of elevation you have to the top of the hill times 0.44, so that will give you your PSI. And then what you can do is, on the same line that you're running water up to the tank, it has back pressure or back feeding onto the line, and you're going to actually put hydrants along that line so that you have access to water anywhere along that fill line up to the tank. It will have back pressure to those hydrants. All right, James, I hope that helps. And you're actually close enough to me that I could easily do a site visit if you ever want me to. But if not, I'm also more than happy to help you with design and answering questions more specifically if you want to reach out. For everybody else, I do homestead design and consulting, and you can find my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com. And as always, until next time, go get your hands dirty.
All right, so let's move on from there. I just wanted to speak to the people that are going, hydraulic ram pump, hydraulic ram pump. Here's the rule with a hydraulic ram pump, because if you could make it work, it would be absolutely ideal, but it is still the case that the main cost of your infrastructure is going to be piping to move water that far. But a standard ratio for about every 1 foot of vertical drop, and it has to be vertical. It can't be the creek descends 10 feet over 100 feet. You have to basically have kind of like a dammed up area and water falling straight down into it. That's how that works. And for every foot fall feeding the pump, it can generally lift 5 to 10 feet vertically. So what that would mean is if you can drop water 10 feet, you can move it to a height of, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 feet. So it's a really great technology. It's a really great primitive technology. It is an infinite energy technology. It is a fantastic technology. But if you wanted to move water 250 feet, you would need water force dropping at about 25 feet, and that is probably not realistic just about anywhere. If you had that, you could literally build a trombe, right? And you could be creating isothermically cooled compressed air, and the amount of energy you had then could put water and other things anywhere you wanted them to go. So it's just not realistic in this scenario, but it's a great technique where it works. Now let's talk about wearable tech for health and fitness with Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia. If you enjoy the tangential nature of my voice, my episodes, my bits, then join me at Fitness, Food, and Finance. That is my podcast where we talk about health and finance and fitness all the time, every week, every Monday at 6 a.m. or something, it gets dropped. Anyway, the question came up, Andy, but what about wearables and trackable and, you know, the things, the whoops and the aura rings and stuff? What do you think about that? So the answer to that one is yes, as long as you're going to do something with the data. Now, even if you're not planning on doing something with the data, I have found some very interesting pieces and points to this. The Whoop and the Oura Ring are going to start building up a database of you, and then it's going to notice when things are off. Now, I would love it if everyone did a heart rate test and a blood pressure test, but we're just not going to do those things. So these wearables kind of take that and build a profile of the things you could or should be doing. One of the biggest ones is your heart rate variability, so HRV. What it's saying is your heart is doing something different than we thought it should be doing, and we just want to let you know that. So a good example of these things is one of my coaches, the ring said, hey, for the last week, your heart rate has been elevated, and your temperature at night, was it temperature or was it sleep? Something about was off. Typically, this means you're pregnant. So she said the ring told her before she was 100% sure and they ever went to the doctor. So they're knowing things ahead of time, and that right there is fantastic. So she knew she was pregnant. They've been trying, so like, I'm pretty sure I'm pregnant. But if you've never been pregnant, you're like, I don't know, am I not? And you got to do the test. Sometimes when you pee on the stick, it needs more pregnancy hormone to be there to say you are or are not. And this was able to do it without the hormone because it has a database of people with those trends, and they can, you know, extrapolate based on human nature and who we are and what we do. So once it understands who you are, I think there's very valuable data that can come from that. Another good one was multiple times back in the 2020 era, people had a device on and they said, I knew I was getting sick and I knew it was COVID because these measurements were coming out, and they had, I guess, a large data pool of all that, right? So then recently I had somebody say they were about to go on a business trip, and they thought, I don't feel too good. They looked at their device, and it said, hey, I think you're about to get sick because, what was it? Their heart rate went up, and they woke up a bunch of times at night, which was unusual for them. And sure enough, they got sick. They did not go on the business trip, and they were sick at home for like 3 or 4 days. So that would have been miserable to be on this business trip out there and about. Now, I say all this, and I don't have any devices. I don't wear a thing. I don't have a ring. I don't have a whoop. I have a love-hate relationship with technology. I think everyone should be assimilated by the Borg because it would make us a better species, and we would know more things. But I love individuality, so I have a hard time with this topic in particular. Yes, I think everybody should do it, and yes, I think nobody should do it. So I think if you could keep your data, then I would be a little bit happier with it. But on the other side is I don't like to sit around with my phone very much. I don't have it on me. I have it away from me. I also have the, like, it's on silent mode all the time. There is no other mode. I don't even get notifications. I only look at my phone when I want to look at the phone, right? So I don't like technology on me. I think doing those earbuds could have some impact on you that's negative. I would say instead use corded earbuds rather than the Bluetooth earbuds. Is it true? I don't know. I just am not that put out that I need those sort of things. So if I was in trouble or in jeopardy or starting a journey, yes, I probably would use it for a while, then maybe take it off. If I was, like, I know Jack talks about this. Hey, I'm in the garden. I use those Anchor earbuds, and they fit the ears just right, and they don't pop out or anything. I agree. If you are like, if I'm out with the chickens, and I'm listening to something, and I need to do a thing, I need to decide, am I touching my chicken poop hands over my stuff? Because you can't tap anything, right? So I think there are cases, like, I'll give you another good one. I don't typically use noise-canceling headphones because I just don't like the way it makes my head feel. But if we're going on a long trip, like on an airplane, I have some really nice Apple, I don't know, the noise-canceling Apple ones that cost like $4 billion. I have those. I don't like to wear them because it does give me a bit of a buzz or a headache. But I'm on a flight. It's super noisy. I can't listen to anything anyway because my hearing is off and there's so much jet noise or, you know, turbine noise or whatever. So I do use it. So there are cases. So if you're not as paranoid as me, then yes, get one of the wearables and try it out. I would probably go for the ring first. It just seems to have a lot more easy data points to grab, but the Whoop's pretty cool too. I also like the Whoop because I think most of the time for that one, or maybe they changed it, there wasn't a subscription. All right, guys, if you have specific questions, you can find me, Andy, at CrossFitGarage.com. You can, of course, find our website is CrossFitGarage.com, and you can hit me that way too. I've got videos on YouTube, and let's see, it's at AndyMcCann42, and then, of course, my podcast is Fitness, Food, and Finance. Y'all take care.
So my view on the wearables actually meshed with Andy's really well. I was like, and then I saw this question and saw that he went ahead and answered it. Here's my concern. I think that wearable tech can do a lot of things. It can help us with our goals. It can help us keep track of our fitness. I think in some cases, for some people, it might even save a life. Okay. However, I think it has a great potential to do more harm than good, because many people who don't think of themselves as hypochondriacs are. And if every time your blood pressure spikes to high, whatever that means to you, you start worrying about it, you will spike your blood pressure more often. I can literally cause your blood pressure to spike with what I say or do or what I put in front of you. And I can also do things that will cause your blood pressure to go down. We have a tremendous, just blood pressure alone, we have a tremendous effect on our blood pressure, on our heart rate. And that kind of dovetails into our next topic about hunting when we compare archery to rifle hunting, which I plan to do in my response. So I'll just say that I agree with the way Andy put it. If you use it and you basically get information when you want the information instead of having it thrown at you every time something goes anywhere outside of what's considered the normal band, It's probably useful. And for most people, you probably don't need it. It's something I think that's very specific to the individual. With that, let's hear from Mike Melito on a totally different subject, but the heart rate will come into this. Why we hunt.
Hey, TSP. Michael here on the Expert Council to answer your gun-related questions and talk gun and gun-adjacent topics. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about why hunt. The obvious answer, food. But today I wanted to talk about it in a little bit different light. When I polled my audience, I was surprised at the well, that it was a minority of people that actually hunted. So I thought I'd go at this from a little bit different perspective. What's Jack's tagline? If times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, how about this for apologetics of hunting? We live in an increasingly urbanized, I would submit, unnatural world, full of cubes and straight lines and freeways and smart this and social media that. I would submit that is not good for us, body or soul. Getting some time in a more natural environment, getting out into the beauty of God's creation, enjoying it. Now, I'm not going to pretend hunting is the only way to do that. It certainly is not. That would be dishonest. There's many ways to do that. But certainly hunting is a way that we can do that. Get out into the beauty of creation. Enjoy it. A world without straight lines. A world without a world where you hear a meadowlark instead of an alarm. An elk bugle instead of a social media post. The running water of a clear stream instead of the rolling screen of doom scrolling. I think that's good for us. I think that may be one of the primary benefits of hunting that really I don't think gets talked about. We live, many of us, a majority of the time in that world, in that urban sprawl, that man-made, largely artificial environment. So I would submit the number one reason you might consider hunting if you're not already a hunter is it's a way to get out of that and get into a, let's say, get into a healthier environment. I don't know how Jack would put it. I know his beliefs differ from mine, but from what I believe, right, God made man and put him in a garden. The first murderer in the Bible, Cain, built the first city. Just think about that. I think a lot of culture today makes us think that the great outdoors, the mountains and the streams and the elk, they're like this one thing, and humans are like this whole separate thing that live in their own separate environments. Well, I reject that. We are part of that creation. We were made just the same. We're not, despite what, you know, the History Channel garbage, however long that's been going on, I don't have TV, but I'm aware of the show Ancient Aliens. You didn't come from some faraway place and just land here. You're from here. We're native species to here, just like everything else. We ought to be a little bit more connected with the environment. I mean that in some new age hippie kind of way. I mean, get out in it. Get dirty. Get, you know, dirt under your fingernails. Maybe blood on your hands. Remember where food actually comes from. And I know many of you guys in this audience probably know that, but not everybody. The next reason is obviously food. Good, high quality protein. Natural food. Now, obviously hunting, again, is not the only way to do this, right? You can fish, you can forage. I love both those things. But hunting is certainly a way to do that, to get good quality food. As much as anti-hunters like to paint us in a negative light, those animals that we hunt and, God willing, take cleanly suffer very little. And think about the lives that they live until we harvest them versus the life of many animals like cows in a CAFO or chickens in a mass-produced chicken house. It's a far better life that they live. And even if you don't eat meat, probably eat stuff grown on farms, which means you have to get rid of the animals that would normally eat that food or be in that space. So really nobody's hands are without blood in this, whether you're a full-fledged vegan. Hunting is a way for us to get our own food in a world so disconnected from the food chain. That is a good thing. Me being able to go out with a rifle or bow or shotgun or whatever and go out and head out into the woods, the wilderness, the desert, the Great Plains, and bring back good, nutritious food for myself, for my wife, put it on the table, cook it, jerky it, make sausage, all that stuff. It's fantastic. Right, there's nothing wrong with going to work, making money, going to the store and buying food. I certainly do that, right? I'm not a hypocrite. I get that. That is a way for you to turn your skill into food. You trade your time, labor, for currency that you then buy food with? Well, I'd submit, cut out the middlemen. Take your skill and go turn it into food more directly in hunting. Get out, enjoy creation, be a part of it. It's a world made for us to be in and interact with, and I think we'd all be better off if we did more of it. Those are my thoughts on hunting and maybe a different pitch to get you to try hunting. Now is a good time to start thinking about it. I know most hunting happens in the fall, but now's the time to start thinking about it, getting ready for it. Now, we're not have time in this segment to do a quick how-to, but just at least consider it. Think about it. Think about if you've never hunted a day in your life, why you might want to do it. If times get tough, or even if they don't, think it's good for us. I imagine Jack will have much to say on this topic, as I, from listening to him over the years, I know he loves hunting. And I know that it probably means more to him than just the meat. There's something more there. Love to hear your thoughts on that, Jack. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP. Remember to send your gun-related questions in. Michael here, Gunfighter Life Podcast. Thanks for having me, and have a blessed day.
So Mike is correct that we have a different spiritual belief system, but it may not be as different as he might imagine. I do not ascribe to any organized faith, and I don't hold anything against anybody that does. It's just I can't pretend to believe something I don't believe, and I think any reasonable person should actually appreciate that and consider it virtuous that I wouldn't lie to you about what I believe. I wouldn't pretend. I wouldn't hedge my bets spiritually, etc. However, I do believe that we are put here with a purpose, and whether that put here means physically, intentionally put here, or a grand plan of a central, great singularity of intelligence and knowledge and being and spirit, which is kind of what I believe in, what I would call God, or through evolutionary means, I don't care how. I think that's true anyway. Whether you're right, I'm right, or somebody else is right, we are here as a being with a purpose. When people speak about nature and humanity as though those two things are separate entities, I think there's a huge mistake. That does not mean we have a free pass to fuck shit up. It does not mean we have a free pass to bulldoze all the trees down. It does not mean we should build a city everywhere we can find a place to build a city. It does not mean we should spread our population to 100 gazillion billion. Okay? What I'm saying, though, is humans are as native to Earth as a tree or a frog or a snake or a bumblebee. We belong here too. We belong here too. And there's certain things we can do better, and there's certain things we do pretty well already. Okay? We are, well, all I'm saying is we are part of this system we call Earth. That you are as natural as a squirrel, a chipmunk, a bear, or a frickin' dog fart. You are natural. You belong here. You evolved here, whether you did it through creation or pure evolution or something in the middle. You have the hands you do because they function a certain way on this planet. You breathe the atmosphere. You contribute to it in your exhalation. You provide plant food. You recycle organic matter through your poop and your pee. You die and you rot and dust onto dust and to dust that you return. And the truth is you make soil. And you feed fungi and bacteria, you belong here, okay? But I think that a lot of the reason we have this difficulty accepting that is because we've built so much that has created a false separation. And I think there are many things that blow up the illusion of that separation: hiking, fishing, foraging, gardening, real agriculture, not the culture of fields, but true horticulture and animal husbandry and functioning in the ecosystem. But I think that one of the true wall destroyers of that is hunting. Because man, no matter how much the vegan wants it to not be true, is separated from other beings in one way, in that we are naturally hunters. And the people that try to make the case that a man can't hunt and run down a gazelle and bite it in the neck like a lion. No, we make tools. We make tools. You know, we make tools. That's how we hunt. And we're smart. And we use our brain and we use our intellect. And we create traps. And we create scenarios that give us the advantage. Like a hunter. No you can take two very different predators and they have very different methods. A snake, if it's a non-venomous constrictor, bites an animal that looks like it's too big to even eat, constricts around it, gives it basically a cardiac concussion, compresses the air out of its lungs, asphyxiates it, and swallows it whole. A cat, like a bobcat or a cougar, might attack an animal about the same size, snap its neck, tear it apart, and eat it. They ate the same animal, totally different methodology. One is not less predator because it did it differently. Got it? So when we take an animal's life to consume it, we are a predator and we have earned that. We have earned the right to consume that animal. Is, you know, that's how I feel. And this is where I said the heart rate thing would come back into it. I don't know if you can fully comprehend, and I'm not putting it down because I mostly rifle hunt due to time constraints today, but I don't think you can fully comprehend the full nature of man as a predator unless you drop at least to the level of archery. Now, you could drop further, but if you drop at least to the level of archery and you're hunting, you know, mid-sized to large game, something like deer and up, when you do this, and I think that it's one of those things that you cannot comprehend it till you experience it, everything is different. You know, the tunnel vision we talked about in stressful situations with Joe Riles yesterday, that happens there in a different way. Because you're not afraid it's going to kill you. You're not afraid a deer is going to climb up a tree and kill you. But there is almost a blurred tunnel that forms around the outskirts, which is in some ways a little similar to a near-death experience, just a little bit, not fully. You hear your heartbeat. If you're wearing a watch, and I don't mean a digital, I mean an old school wind-up tick, 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 tick watch, you have no idea how loud it is until that moment, and you're thinking, why did I wear this watch? I know that deer can hear it. I know that deer can hear my heart. I know that deer can hear my breathing. And there's something else that happens, and sometimes this happens in rifle hunting, but never quite to the level it does with archery, especially in thick woods where you can't see at distance. There'll be a moment. You won't hear anything. You won't see anything. You won't smell anything. You will just know something's here. There is a part in us innately where we evolved or created, describe it however you want, as two things, predator and prey. For a lot of humanity, there were a lot of animals that simply looked at a human being and said, I'll eat that hairless monkey. And there's still places where that happens. There's still places where that happens. There's places where, like, people get killed, the animal doesn't really want to eat you. Like, the number one thing that kills people in Africa is hippos. They just get hippo rage and kill because they're pissed. But the number two animal, it's not lions. It's not leopards. It's crocodiles. And when a crocodile grabs somebody, they take them into the water and they eat them. Jaguars eat people. Certain bears eat people. Not bite, not attack, not maul, eat. And if you go back just 10,000-ish years before we lost a lot of the megafauna, there were a lot of other predators that just went, I'll eat that hairless monkey. So we have prey and predator in our DNA. And when we hunt, and when you hear nothing, smell nothing, see nothing, feel nothing on the outside, but you feel it on the inside, and the hairs and the hackles on the back of your neck go up, and then there's the animal that comes out in total silence, whether it's the target animal or not, you're touching that. We hunt for a lot of reasons. I'll save my other thoughts for a future show that I'm going to call Why We Hunt. But that's a big one for me right there. It puts us in touch with who and what we really are. With that, let's go ahead and talk about the future of TSP, Jack's Laws, the book series, and a bunch of other stuff. So, yes, I am going to a 3-day-a-week show schedule. And as I said in the intro, this has been in the work about 5 years. It was probably 5 years ago that I first came up with the idea, how do I go to 4 days a week and how do I get to 3? And over those years, I tried a few different things. I tried Friday flashbacks. I tried a bunch of like stand-in shows for the Friday show. And eventually I realized, just don't do a show on Friday. And then that was always part of a stepping stone to 3 days a week. And the way I looked at it is, 3 days a week, when you have a catalog that's 18 years deep, and over 3,800 episodes, there's always something for somebody to listen to at this point. I've paid the dues, and that's where I want to be. And the beauty of that is, that gives me a Friday to a Monday where I don't have a definitive thing that I have to do in a specific way. And it puts me into a state of semi-retirement. And, you know, I'm in my mid-50s. I want to be there. Like, I don't want to wait. I also have a wife that, for those that don't know, is a bit older than me. And so, you know, with that in mind, she wants to travel. She wants me in her life. She wants me to have, like, a partial retirement to spend with her. So that was always the plan. The other side of it is part of what she wants to do with the time that we have left, right, is she wants to travel. And so one of the ways that I can have us travel and make the trips tax deductible and have them partially paid for is to do some speaking engagements, something that I have turned down left and right over the years. And so one of the things that I will be doing in the future is more professional speaking engagements. This does not mean that I will travel 2,000 miles to speak for free at your garden club meeting. I cannot do that. That is not the type of thing I'm talking about. Not that if it wasn't where I was going to be anyway, I might not do it, because I would, you know, for a lot of people. But like, that's not the business plan. The business plan is higher end speaking engagements. I will be, like I said earlier this week, I will be speaking in West Virginia at the West Virginia Homeschool Convention. I cut my fee by about 2/3, and I thought it was still too much for them. And they said, we got it. We got you. So I'll be going to do that. But that's kind of like the lowest we're talking about, you know. So I'm looking at doing more business, professional consulting, things like that. I'm a draw, but I'm not like the guy that draws in like thousands of people just because I'm going to be there. My value is in the information that I can convey, what I can teach, what I can leave people with. And I'd actually like to do some things that are more designed on like multi-day consultancy speaking and training. And so that you don't have to worry about that unless you just think you're a good fit for it and you want to reach out about it. But there's the new website, jackslaws.com, will continue to get refined. And that's the home base for that, which is also my books, my writing, and everything else. The books, again, the Laws of Life books, have become something far more than I ever intended on. The first book was just kind of like, I'll just kind of throw some autobiographical thing and lessons and all these laws I talked about into a book, and it was okay. And when I did the second book and the work that I did to get ready for it and the work that I did during it and the development that I did during it, it really, I know you think it's just marketing, guys, but it really does blow the first book completely out of the water. That is why the second book, I put months into the second edition of the first book. Months. This was not just clean it up and add some new stuff. This is 20,000 words of new content. This is framework formulas, etc. When I built that set, my intention was then to write a book called North Star. That's all it's called for now. It's like a code name. And it was designed to be kind of like a next step in that process of self-development. And along the way, AI really caught my eye, right? And I started to become very proficient with it and learn a lot about what you could do with it. And then I realized how it plugged into what I was doing. Then Tim, known as Karaoke Tim at our workshops, said, me, myself, and AI during a live stream. And I went, that fits exactly what I want to do. I'm stealing it. It turns out other people have used it, but you can't trademark a term like that. So I will be using it, and I'm writing a book called Me, Myself, and AI. That book's written about a third already. As I was putting that together, though, and as I was doing, and then I'm like, I got to get all this stuff ready for the marketing and stuff. Like, writing a book, is you got to have it formatted. You got to do the design work. You got to get all the collateral together. Like, you got to promote it. Like, okay, I have to take a pause, back up, and do these. And I started looking at them, and I said, these books are an online course waiting to happen. Every chapter has this certain formula now. It opens with quotes. It ends with a distill. It ends with a framework formula. All the chapters have code rewrites. When you guys see the coursework and the workbooks come out, you're going to go, this dude totally wrote these books so he could write the course. I didn't. I wish I thought, I'm that smart, right? I'm such a genius. No, I didn't. I just looked at books in this genre and took, like, Jeet Kune Do, right? Like, what works in other spaces, and let's put it together, let's assemble it. The quote idea, honestly, guys, it came from one of my old TV shows I used to love to watch, Criminal Minds. If you watch Criminal Minds, it always opens up with a quote by, like, an author or something, and it closes with one. And I went, that's kind of cool. You like to quote people. Why don't you formalize it into your process? So that happened in the second book. Then I was reading some book, and it was about, like, the most important highlights of the chapter, like a cliff notes at the end. I went, I should do that. And I had a discussion with AI, and we get the word with distill. Distilling it down, it kind of fits my brand. So we created the chapter distill. And then I thought about how people have frameworks, like Jeff Woods with CRIT, right? Context, role, interview, task. And went, all of these things have basically a filtering mechanism built into them. Why don't we just distill that down into a formula that's named? And you will find out when you read the second book, if you do, that I'm being completely honest with you, that it was an afterthought. I was halfway through the book before I did it. Because there is what I call a unicorn chapter in the second book. There is one chapter, I won't say what it is yet, there's a formula in it, but it's not named. It's not like ship, right? Or it's not like wise, or it's not like, there's one called the standard formula. There's one called the CIA method. Like, I tried to be clever with that, and I'll be straight up. I took what I wanted to do. I bounced it off AI and said, help me come up with a mnemonic. And then it came up with a mnemonic and threw like a phrase on each letter, and then I wrote the formulas out based on my prior work. Well, the point being that clearly that was retrofitted in. It wasn't originally planned because there's that one chapter. And that one chapter, when I read it, I'm like, it's already in there, very clear how to run the process, so I don't want to force a name on it now, and decided not to. So this all kind of happened by happenstance. And then I came up, so I had both books done. And I was starting to work on that's how I got a third of Me, Myself, and AI written. And I sat back and went, wait a minute. You need to, this is like I said, you got to get ready for these two book launches. Just because you handed them to the editor and the formatter doesn't mean your job's over. You've got to take care of the KDB backend. You've got to set up I got translations now in all the Kindle. Not in print, but like my book in my second edition now in Kindle is in French, it's in Spanish, it's in Italian, it's in German. Like, to set all that up doesn't take a lot of time, but you have to figure out how to do it. So I started working on all that, and as I'm doing it, I'm like, always optimize what you have before you move on to the next thing. That's one of my unwritten laws of life. And I started looking at this book, and I went, this book is a workbook and a course waiting to happen. And I thought, I'll just knock that out in a week per book. It'll be easy because all the stuff's there. Yeah? So I went into AI and thought, I'll just ask it to make a template for me, and it did, and it sucked. And I talked about it, and it sucked, and it sucked, and it sucked. And I finally said, screw this. I have to write the template myself. And instead of writing a template, what I did is I wrote the intro part of the book explaining everything. And then I wrote Law 1, Week 1. And I wrote the coursework for that week. And I wrote it completely from scratch. And then I went back and said, now let's copy and paste it. Let's remove everything that won't work. Everything that's custom tailored to Week 1. Let's remove it from Week 2. Now I have a template. Now let's make a copy of that, and now that's my template for each week. Now it starts rolling. It still takes me about a day per chapter to do the workbook. And I put so much thought into the way to arrange the workbook that, are you ready for this? Because many of you didn't read it, I'm sure, when I put it out. You could take the course or just use the workbook. The course will provide additional guidance and support and encouragement and tracking, and it'll be inexpensive. The workbook can be used by itself without the coursework at all. But in the workbook, when you're done per book, you'll have this, what I call long-term code. Just something that will take you a minute or two every day to review, that you will have custom built for yourself that will rotate over a 16-day period. So about twice a month, roughly, you'll use the same material and you'll go through it. And it's not my material, even though it's based on my material. It's your material that you'll develop in your work in the book. And if two people take the course, I don't care if they're twins, right? Genetically twins, unless they copy each other's answers, the odds that you'll come with the same output as your twin brother is one, and I shit you not, I quadruple check the math, one in 436 trillion. Your mind cannot get around that number. It is like 10 to the 16th power or something. It is enough unique paths to give every human who has ever lived in all of human history millions of completely personal combinations. And it has to do with something one of my former mentors, Frank Madron, did when I was in Ethernet hardware. We had modular Ethernet hardware, and he had one of our engineers calculate, like, well, how many options really are there with the Garrett 6K systems? And the answer was 64,000 combinations. And Frank was very smart. He did that because we sold to engineers, and he knew engineers would be like, bullshit. But he also knew engineers were smart enough to calculate it, and they would calculate it. I'd be like, shit, you guys didn't lie in your marketing. Crap. There really is that many combinations. And what that did is it cemented us into their mind forever. Like, if somebody said Garrett, they heard Calm. Like, we were forever. Frank was a brilliant dude. And so when I was putting this together and I started thinking about the combinations, like, you pick one distill, you pick one code, you pick one quote, like, and then you do these other things and you make this list. How many combinations are there in 16 of the variables? And it is 1 in 436 trillion. It's more stars in the observable universe. More combinations than stars in the available universe. And the way I do it, you're getting into Bitcoin private key territory if you do everything that's in the book. So it's totally unique, and yet it's based on a template. And it's totally customized, but there's more. As I've been building it, I've actually figured out why what I do works from a neuroscientific and psychological standpoint, including things like how neural pathways are formed, almost like a path in the woods that if you walk over it enough times, you wear it in and it becomes the default path. And in that, I've actually started using Notebook LM, and I know how some of you feel about that, but I have been using this now for about 2 years and refining my technique with it, and I've gotten very, very good with it. And those of you that take the course, you'll do one module a day, 1 week per law. So it's a 16-week course. Nobody judges it, and you can go through slower or faster if you want to, though I don't recommend faster. More on that will come later. But you can go slower for sure, especially day one. Day one's the heavy lifting. And then it time-wise, anyway. But each module has about a 4 to 5 minute audio that goes with it if you take the course. And the audio was done so that the two people speaking are a neuroscientist and a PhD in psychology. They don't just explain what to do and motivate you to do it, but explain why it works and how it works, which I think magnifies the effect. And I sit back now and look at what I've built with this, and I go, oh, wow. And I literally would love to have somebody in this audience who is a neuroscientist, because I know we have to have some, or a psychologist take it and take a look at it and give me their opinion on it. Because I think this might be one of the most definitive pieces of self-work a person can do on themselves. And it will change so much about, I know that when you read some of my laws, especially if you haven't read the book and you read something like always be on time, you think, I'm always on time. It's so much deeper. The understanding of what temporal capital really is, the finite nature of temporal capital, the fact that you can't get it back, what it says about you when you look at the way you view time and what you view as good enough and what you view as not good enough, both to the negative and to the positive, and that's one of the most surface level laws there is. Some of this other stuff, and what really got me was what happened with the one about state power with the segments coming out of Notebook, something you'll have to wait to find out about. In any event, the work coming out of Laws of Life is extensive. It has me wanting to, and I don't know if I have it in me with all these other things, it has me wanting to distill those down into like a kid's version. like, you know, like a 10 to 14 or 10 to 16 version. Because I really think the books as they are sit are kind of like your entry points about 15 to 16 years of age. But it's definitely worth checking out, and make sure you don't miss the launch of Laws of Life 2, even if you're not going to buy the second edition of Laws of Life 1. And I say that very selfishly, because I know if you buy Laws of Life 2, you're going to turn around and buy Laws of Life 1. I know it's going to happen. On the speaking stuff, like, again, I am looking for more like professional level, executive level speaking engagements. If you are part of an organization and you think that might be beneficial, and I really want to talk about things like lifestyle design, operational design, and how AI fits into the modern world. And by the way, I just booked somebody to talk about AI. I know some of you, AI is a demon, whatever, I can't help you then, right? We're designing a life that survives the modern world, and AI is part of it. And AI is a fluctuation and a change, and if you're not ready for that, get run over by it. But I have a guy that's going to come on and pretty soon and talk to us. He's done 50 AI corporate implementations, 50 different companies, 50 different implementations. That is a vantage point. There aren't many people who can say that yet, because it hasn't been going on that long. And these are real implementations that do real things, not the vaporware crap that I've covered that companies like Amazon have done, where it's all performative. These are more like your mid-tier companies, not your little tiny ones, you know, not your one-man operations or your five-man tire shop, but, you know, you're talking about companies that are 500 to a couple thousand people, not people, you know, they just spend money like water because they can. I think it's going to be really interesting. And this is the type of thing I want to do going forward. And I do hope that all of you who have been with me all these years don't hold anything against me finally pulling back one more day to do all these other things. Because when I pulled back to 4, I told you certain things would happen, and I kept my word to you, and they did. And there is no plan just to give it to you, you know, any time in the near future, you know, like 5 years-ish, to go to 2 or something like that, or 1, or stop doing the podcast. This was kind of the goal all along. It fits a really nice week for me. I can take a week and do a tremendous amount of work on my other things, or I can take a week and spend a long weekend with my wife, depending on what's happening that weekend. And that's just something that at this point in our life we need to do. And I've also tried to always model behavior and say, like, if you want a great life, and then this is what that looks like. I think it looks pretty good. Anyway, with that, I'll sign off for the week, and I hope you enjoyed today's show. I know that my ending today was a little different than typical, but we're in a fluctuation period, and I wanted you guys to know, and you won't hear a tremendous more like that in the future. You hear about what's going on, but you won't have me talk for 15 minutes about just that, okay? Anyway, with that, have a great weekend. I'll catch you on Tuesday with another great show. It won't be Why We Hunt. I don't know what it's going to be yet. But if you have some suggestions, as always, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC in the subject line.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.